From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View, your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. Since February is Heart Month, and last Friday was Wear Red for Women Day, and I wore a beautiful red tie to celebrate our efforts to educate and raise awareness for heart disease in women, I decided to select two topics today that are very relevant to that particular area. One of them is an article looking at blood pressures in women who have severe preeclampsia during pregnancy. And the other is a recent update on cardiovascular disease and breast cancer, articles that would be useful to our audience and particularly relevant for this time of year. So the first article was published this week in Hypertension. And the question asks, what's the prevalence of hypertension in women a year after having had pregnancy complicated by severe preeclampsia? And this was a study looking at 200 women who had severe preeclampsia cared for in the Netherlands. These individuals had office blood pressures and ambulatory blood pressure monitoring between 9 and 15 months after their delivery. So there were 200 patients. At 1 year postpartum, 41.5% of the women had hypertension diagnosed by ambulatory blood pressure monitoring. And interestingly, 14% were sustained hypertension. More than that, 17.5% had masked hypertension, and about 9.5% had white coat hypertension. Interestingly, also, only 24% of the women with a diagnosis of hypertension would have been diagnosed if their determination had simply been based on an office measurement. So the authors concluded that hypertension a year after severe eclampsia is very common and that we should consider offering ambulatory blood pressure monitoring or home blood pressure monitoring to these women to identify and treat hypertension in this unique group. Clearly, women with previous preeclampsia are known to be at future increased risk for development of hypertension and cardiovascular disease. In fact, there's a whole new field emerging called gestational cardiology, where we look at what occurs with glucose control, blood pressure control around the time of pregnancy and delivery as potentially a window to look at future risk. And this is a particularly nice article about this. Clearly, hypertension is common a year after a woman has preeclampsia complicating a pregnancy, and that often this is not going to be diagnosed based on home blood pressure readings alone. This gets at this whole notion of masked hypertension, where patients appear to be borderline or actually in range in the office, and they're high at home. We know that this is a substantial risk factor for cardiovascular disease. The hazard ratio is about 2. Actually much higher than white coat hypertension. So I think this is a very important article for us and certainly should help us think about changing practice. Currently, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists Task Force on Hypertension in Pregnancy recommends annual blood pressure, lipids, fasting blood sugar, and BMI measurements in these women. Clearly, they should be offered ambulatory blood pressure monitoring if the blood pressure in the office is normal, or is borderline, looking for this entity called masked hypertension. Now, the second article I wanted to talk about today is a very nice review that came out this week in Circulation on cardiovascular disease and breast cancer. Obviously, we're all aware that the field of cardio-oncology is just exploding as we began to deal with cancer survivorship and the frequency of cardiovascular disease in these individuals. So this was a very elegant review looking at the interface between cardiovascular disease and breast cancer. So a few summary points that I think are relevant for our audience. In older postmenopausal women, the risk of mortality attributable to cardiovascular disease is higher in breast cancer survivors than it is in women who don't have a history of breast cancer. And this risk manifests itself on average about 7 years after the breast cancer diagnosis. Age-adjusted mortality rates for both coronary heart disease and stroke are also higher and are actually higher than those of breast cancer itself. the mortality rates are higher in non-Hispanic black women than in non-Hispanic white and Hispanic women. Cardiovascular disease and breast cancer actually share a number of risk factors, including older age, diet, family history, alcohol use, hormone replacement, being overweight or obese, physical inactivity, and tobacco use. And it appears that adherence to a larger number of the ideal cardiovascular health behaviors or factors are associated with a trend toward not only a lower incidence of cardiovascular disease, but also a lower incidence of breast cancer. Now, we know that cancer treatment can result in early or delayed cardiotoxicity, and that can vary from LV dysfunction to overt heart failure, hypertension, arrhythmias, myocardial ischemia, valvular heart disease, thromboembolic disease, pulmonary hypertension, and pericarditis. We're aware that the most commonly reported and monitored side effect is actually LV dysfunction in people undergoing chemotherapy. So several at-risk groups fall into this category. High-dose anthracycline therapy, that would be doxorubicin more than 250 milligrams per meter squared, or epirubicin more than 600 milligrams per meter squared. A second group would be high-dose radiation when the heart isn't actually in the field of radiation therapy. A third group to think about is people having sequential chemotherapy, such as lower-dose anthracycline like doxorubicin, less than 250 milligrams per meter squared, or epirubicin, less than 600 milligrams per meter squared, followed by therapy with trastuzumab, for example. A fourth category is those people having combination therapy. They might get lower dose anthracycline therapy combined then with lower dose radiation therapy, and this is a group that might have cardiotoxicity. The patients who are more likely to develop cardiotoxicity can be identified. Those include older age at the time of cancer treatment, that would be over the age of 60, more than or equal to two risk factors for cardiovascular disease, such as diabetes, hypertension, dyslipidemia, obesity, smoking, obviously a history of myocardial infarction, prior valvular heart disease, or having a low normal left ventricular ejection fraction before starting cardiotoxic chemotherapy or radiation therapy. We're also aware that radiotherapy can cause coronary atherosclerosis and accelerated endothelial injury. This can be seen as early as 5 years after exposure among breast cancer survivors who get left-sided thoracic radiation therapy. And this risk persists up to 30 years. And you may recall that sometimes this is a particularly interesting type of coronary disease causing sort of an ostial shelf right at the bifurcation of the coronary ostia coming off of the aorta. And my experience with these is they can be fairly subtle to diagnose, and often, obviously, left main disease can be a very nasty issue. So monitoring is an important thing to think about, and we have a number of ways to do this. Traditional echo, and more recently, strain imaging is being used more and more. MUGA scans have been the traditional way, looking for left ventricular ejection fraction in patients having chemotherapy. But be aware that this is exposing patients to radiation itself. And so looking for other techniques, including strain imaging with echo or cardiac MRI and potentially feature tracking with MR is one thought. And what is the role of biomarkers, particularly, for instance, troponins and BNP? These are all areas of active research. In terms of treatment, if you think about the drugs that we might use to either prevent or treat chemotherapy or radiation-induced LV dysfunction, consider beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, ARBs, spironolactone, we don't have large trials. And so currently, the recommendation of this particular article is that we should just follow the American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association heart failure guidelines in terms of who should be treated with which agents. Interestingly, I've seen a sneak preview. There are several preventive trials that will be presented as late-breaking clinical trials at this spring's American College of Cardiology meeting. We'll all be very anxious to see the results of those because this is an area of active research and a lot of uncertainty. So we don't have definitive guidelines specifically to cardiovascular prevention in breast cancer patients right now because most of the studies have been small and the endpoints have had variable definitions. So this article concludes with the notion that comprehensive care is an essential element in the management of cancer victims to not only maximize cancer therapy, but also minimize the potential deleterious effects on cardiovascular health. And this certainly includes surveillance and survivorship programs, and we need randomized prospective trials to study better both how to track and then treat or prevent these types of complications. I think this is an excellent article. It really shines a light on this burgeoning field, but we still have a paucity of randomized clinical data, and until then, we need to use our traditional guideline-based recommendations, and hopefully that will evolve with further trials over the next few years. This week, I covered two articles, one looking at blood pressure profiles after patients have preeclampsia, and the other, a very nice review in Circulation, looking at the interface between cardiovascular disease and breast cancer therapy. So I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from acc.org. This is Heart Month, and last Friday was Wear Red for Women, and I celebrate the efforts of both the college and all of our societies to attack cardiovascular disease in women, its proper diagnosis, prevention, and more effective therapy. Thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View, and have a great week.